Welcome to the Spoolcast. Stephanie Hay joins Adam Churchill in this follow-up to her virtual seminar, Building Trust with Your Users Through Messaging and Copy. Steph didn't have time to answer all the questions during the seminar, so we decided to address those remaining questions in this podcast. If you didn't attend the seminar, don't worry. There's plenty here for you, too. And now, here's Adam.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Spoolcast. Recently, Stephanie Hay presented a virtual seminar called Building Trust with Your Users Through Messaging and Copy. Many products and services promise to be the easiest, smartest, and best things ever. The problem is, they're just not. And this disconnect between marketing and reality is building a web of skeptics. Fortunately, anyone can build trust with users by setting realistic expectations and then meeting them. In this recent virtual seminar, Stephanie Hay shows how to get started by taking cues from online and offline interactions, actually even before you start writing your candid content. She shows how to craft helpful user experiences and how to maintain users' confidence, even in cases where you fail. Hey, Steph, welcome back.
Thank you, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing great. So what's going on?
Not much. Listen, I forgot if I had ever told you about that time that Jared was in town at an event apart.
No.
Last August. Did I tell you this? Sorry. This is sort of a little bit related to the talk today, but I just wanted to tell you because I keep forgetting to tell you. And feel free to obviously edit this out. But anyway, okay, so here, I was having dinner last August when Jared was in town for an event apart. We were having dinner at Vermilion in Alexandria, just chatting about web things, food things, whatever, awesome things. Anyway, so I started eating, I think it was like some bruschetta or something. This is so embarrassing. Anyway, then this little cherry tomato got lodged in my throat and I'm suddenly finding myself, I was totally choking, dude. So I was like, okay, am I really choking here? Only yes, I was, because I start making the universal sign for choking and that just happens. And so Jared immediately like flies out of his chair and like yanks me out of mine, starts doing the Heimlich. No, dude, I'm not kidding. And then, so like, I felt like it was maybe 30 minutes later, but it was probably 5 seconds. Tomato gets dislodged, blammo, out it comes. It was sort of a fancy restaurant too. So, but I actually caught it because I was like, totally, you know, I have reflexes like a cheetah, even while being saved by Jared Spool's Heimlich abilities.
He never mentioned that. Oh my gosh.
Seriously, I know. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. That never happened. April Fool, I got you.
Oh, man.
I totally got you.
So for folks listening in, yes, we are recording on April 1st, April Fool's Day.
It was so terrible. You know what? But Jared Spool would completely do something like that anyway. He probably has saved my life.
He is a superhero.
Yeah. All right. So I'm sorry to bum everybody out who imagined Jared Spool in a Superman shirt. He probably does wear them. You know, but anyway, that was dumb. I'm sorry, but thank you for humoring me. Anyway, okay, so now I gotta get into like what I'm actually gonna be talking to you about. Why I said this actually relates a little bit to my talk is because this is the sort of ridiculous story that illustrates what's rampant in marketing, which is that people can sort of say whatever they want, however they want, whenever they want. It's actually why, you know, recently, as an example, I just terminated my contract with Verizon because I was told by a real person on the phone that I'd have coverage in the UK, which I didn't. And of course, I landed in London. My buddy Sebley was going to be picking me up. He's driving up from Brighton, like an hour and a half away. And the snow had just fallen and I was stuck in Heathrow and I had no way of contacting him. And here I had thought, because Verizon told me that I was going to have coverage, that I would have coverage. So when I called to inquire why I didn't when I had landed, they said, oh yeah, no, it wouldn't have worked. Sorry. I was like, what? That's after the fact. But, you know, ahead of time, they were all too happy to get my extra money. And, you know, actually, Unroll.me is another example. It sounds awesome. It's this service that I actually found out from Des Trainer on Twitter one day. He suggested it was a great way to unsubscribe from emails all at once. So I gave it a try, but it totally destroyed my inbox, let alone that it didn't actually give me one-click unsubscribe. It was rather just another interface to unsubscribe from emails one at a time. So in both of these cases, though, like the untruths in the content, ones that go after the immediate sale, rather than just telling me the truth about their product up front, about what its capabilities are, And being realistic about that translated to at least me, one person not willing to pay them or use their product anymore and talk about it on podcasts, I guess, too. So I have to imagine that there is a coefficient about what happens because of this, like something viral on the disincentive side. Like that is where I tell people about these experiences on podcasts like these or just in person. And there are some percentage less likely to try the product now, people who hear about it. I'm assuming people have done some research on this, right?
So can you help me understand this? You're saying that content marketing isn't just about the one-to-one relationship that companies are trying to create with their customers. Is that what I'm hearing?
Exactly. I mean, content marketing is the one-to-one-to-many relationship that companies build with their customer and that customer's network. So organizations fail when they prioritize getting the sale right now. Like think classic stereotypical bait and switch techniques we'd expect from, say, a super crappy mattress salesperson. These sorts of techniques work against a company's ability to gain credibility if they can't deliver 100%. That's what I mean when I'm talking about the Verizon or the Unroll.me examples, is because like they couldn't deliver what they told me they were going to deliver 100%. Even a version of that is still to some degree an untruth that you could totally prevent. So as another example, like pulling Jared Spool into the conversation again, this time without a terrible lie story. Anyway, think of his regular updates on the performance of United. He doesn't need to be angry in his tweets about how United can take, quote, landing early, the one from Sunday or whatever, landing early to late gate arrival. In fact, he calls this ability of theirs magical. And he uses hashtags like tarmac prisoner. I mean, it's hilarious. And then two people tweeted back to him, one saying something like United is the worst, and another one saying, like, I'm dreading getting on this United flight because of Jared's tweets. So he's influencing how people feel about United just by talking about what's actually happening in his experience with their service. And that's why I worked so hard in that recent virtual seminar that you opened with to describe different ways you can build trust with people by A, being honest about where you're at, what you can actually do, and then B, delivering on those expectations.
Right, right. So let's talk about the seminar. In it, and it was fantastic, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
In it, you gave our audience 8 techniques, right? 4 content-related and 4 user experience techniques that organizations can use to make marketing and business decisions. And one of the attendees later asked how enterprise companies can build trust with customers using landing pages or email campaigns.
Right. Yeah. The techniques I discuss in my seminar, namely how to gather, analyze, use data to make content and UX decisions that are real and truthful to customers, right? These techniques that I described in the seminar can be applied to any tool or channel and should. So I specifically cite microcopy in forms or email transactions in the seminar. But for general marketing, the takeaway is the same. Effective landing pages or email campaigns speak to people in the language they need to be spoken to in order to understand, because you have to understand something in order to be able to choose it confidently, right? And to not get bitter when it's not right, you know, and then somebody says, well, you didn't understand correctly. It's like, screw you. You didn't describe it correctly. You know, like that's the way life works. So it comes back to content being findable. So technically, you know, for example, from search engines or navigation labels, it's got to be findable and then understandable so that a user can make that choice. Yes, no, confidently.
Right. Now, you've worked with a lot of startups, including your own. How is startup marketing similar to or different from this example of enterprise organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, more than I think it's the industry, is it an enterprise or is it a startup? I think it depends on culture. So companies big or small that are committed internally and consistently to, you know, quote unquote, data-driven decision-making, which is looking at their analytics, you know, on a regular basis, conducting concerted experiments, and then choosing how to grow and change their business based on that data are inherently strategic. These are organizations that are inherently strategic because they're not just throwing shit against the wall and going, hey, did that work or not work? Not that there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but organizations that really look at their data have a content strategy, even if they don't know they do, because their internal and external communications are responsive to and driven by this real commitment to analysis, this concerted analysis. So, yeah, I mean, on the other hand, though, I've worked with startups and content-heavy organizations alike that invent their marketing in conference rooms filled with people, you know, have strong opinions and arguments. And that's what I mean about throwing it against the wall. It's not to say that it doesn't work. I mean, great ideas can come from anywhere. Genius design is a thing. It's not just analyzing trends and data, though I tend to prefer this approach personally. Because what I believe, politics and personalities exist in startups or big companies. And the content strategy in these kinds of environments relies on who wins the room of decision makers. So that's a long way of saying that startups and enterprise organizations don't differ much in their goals. They want to grow or sustain their growth, and they see marketing as a process for achieving that. But where they differ entirely is how they get there. Do they pay attention to the data and strategically decide how to move based on those interpretations? Or do they take into account trends and throw ideas against the wall in hopes they stick? So obviously the world isn't so black and white, but in the content strategy work I've done for the past 10 years, most experiences do fall into one of these two buckets. And in fact, honestly, the majority are driven by politics and personalities rather than the data. I just happen to think that the user rarely wins in those situations.
Can you say a bit more about that? Why is that?
Well, because often this is where the product, service, or language becomes overly complicated. I mean, this is where the confusion happens. When you're trying to win arguments in a boardroom that end up trying to translate to a user as the end result, it's like trying to balance someone's opinion of how things should be rather than being exactly what the user wants. So in an example, it's the Microsoft Word versus Google Doc. I use this all the time. Microsoft Word has everything every user or decision maker has asked for. So it seems like I don't use 90% of the features in Microsoft Word. And the ones I do somehow create like crazy formatting bugs. It just drives me bananas. Anyway, so for example, actually, I recently conducted a UX audit. Fantastic product. Been around for about a year. It's changing the way conference calls are happening. You do it by a link. You don't have a pin. It's very cool. Anyway, they just launched an iPhone app. It didn't really tie into their web-based app. Their web-based app was their original product. So they were working on creating this Dropbox integration and updating their UI so people could do a bunch of new things. And when I started working with them last year, I kept hammering them to give me data on a variety of their features. Like, which of these features are people actually using? You know, are people using the Dropbox integration, that sort of thing? And it turned out that the majority of the work or the things that even they were planning to do, I mean, it wasn't merited. People weren't using those features already. 66% of people were doing only the thing that they were doing since the company launched. They were having these conference calls, and they were like really psyched about it, and they were doing a great job. And then 33% of the people were trying to use one of the features that came shortly after launch but hadn't really gotten much love, and it really wasn't working that well. So effectively, like a third of the people were having a poor user experience. And two-thirds of the people were ignoring all the work the company had done over the course of, like, you know, 6 months or something. And just to be able to sit down and say, okay, let's pay attention to this, it was really an enlightening experience for everybody who was involved because it just completely reprioritized the way that they needed to make design, business, and marketing decisions. And that's where the Google Docs side of things comes into play, right? Like, it also manages to give me what I need. It's not perfect, but it seems to have found a place in being exactly what I needed to be and millions of other users. And I think that's also because Google is self-proclaimed and the people I know who work there also validated that it's a big data company. They pay attention to the data.
So I think that also speaks to a question that came in during the virtual seminar. Vanessa asked, what if CEOs or stakeholders ignore that data evidence, say from Google Analytics?
Yeah. I mean, it's always going to happen because it's not so black and white. Usually, I mean, you can interpret the data however you see fit. So that goes for you, the person analyzing it, just as much as the stakeholder listening. So if I lose these arguments, if I say, yo, this is the data, you cannot ignore the data, right? And they ignore the data. I have to imagine it's probably because of the way I either presented the data, maybe it was flawed, maybe the way I gathered the data is flawed. Maybe I just failed to make a good argument as to why this thing I wanted to do was actually being supported by the evidence. I mean, this has all happened to me and continues to happen to me in life. But what astounds me is how often the growth in subscriptions or payments or purchases just isn't there, right? Somebody says to me, hey, we want more quote unquote engagement. And then I say, what's engagement mean to you? And they can't give me an answer. Like, I can't go find any data to support this because this is just some ambiguous term that they're using to make somebody else who's, you know, working with them happy. But if you can boil it down to what is that actual metric, is it subscriptions or payments or purchases or whatever, then you can actually go find that data and track it back to that. And typically, those are the metrics that are really going to make stakeholders pay attention. And I would also say on the other side of this, like why people ignore it is because they think they need to think of what hasn't been done yet. Like, what haven't we done yet? Like, what are we missing here? You know, like, I don't know how many conversations I've been in, like too many. And they're sort of fun in a way because it's like, oh, cool. We're all going to sit around and brainstorm like something cool and innovative. Honestly, I mean, this comes back down to content too. Like, I am such a big believer in simplification. So it's not so much like, what haven't we thought of, but what have we done now that we have overcomplicated? Like, what are we telling people that just isn't true, that just isn't meeting their expectations? If your numbers are showing that you don't have growth somewhere, it may very well be a symptom of what you're confusing, not what you're missing, right? And this is such a core element of why so many awesome, awesome startups fail too. But anyway, so this is a sort of thing that this worked for Craigslist as much as it's worked for Google Docs, right? And actually, Jared just wrote a post on this recently about an e-commerce company spent millions of dollars redoing its purchasing process. We should link to that in the description here. And then after they spent millions to redo their purchase process, their transaction dropped by like 40% or something, which translates to millions of dollars for some of these big companies. I'm sorry, but CEOs and stakeholders cannot ignore that unless they want to lose their jobs. So I'd say UXers and content strategists, people who are core to planning these experiences, need to think about that end result. Like, what is the bottom line to the CEO or the stakeholder really? You know, for them, it's not, they don't feel necessarily, this is not going for everybody, but they don't feel that like empathy that we as practitioners might feel about the users in the same way. You know, they're thinking about what is that metric? And it's, I think, you know, our job, our responsibility to think like a business person when we're analyzing and presenting the data. Users' feelings are often inherently part of that data, you know, if we're just willing to own up to it. And I think it's our responsibility to pay attention to that.
Very cool. Couple of more questions. You have time for us?
Sure.
So Rebecca wanted to know if you could speak a bit more to determining how to balance the amount of detail you provide upfront. In other words, how do we avoid overloading the user right up front with too much information?
Yeah, this is great. This is another reason to pay attention to the data, because in a really concerted content strategy where you're working arm in arm with some user testing, you can and should test what is at this level, what are the core questions that a user has that we need to answer? What are the keywords that the user needs to see in order to feel like he or she can keep scrolling or can click here or can keep reading or whatever the next step is? I mean, the goal here is to know your business so well that you can set up a conversation with users in the same way that you might, you know, have a conversation in real life. I was actually working with a client recently where we did this workshop and I said, okay, I want you to do some role reversal. So the person sitting across from you is you, you know, and you are your user. So start asking questions about your product as if you were the user. And they elicited all these questions that they had as users that they didn't know how to answer because they weren't thinking about the conversation. They were only thinking about what they could say. You know your business so well, but if you can get out of your own mind a little bit and get into the user's shoes and think about what the conversation is like on the other side, you can filter very quickly what the core details you need, what's the core content you need to have up front. And then what is the way that that conversation continues to flow where the person continues to get more detailed as those core questions continue to be answered. So to be able to have an offline conversation with somebody that's realistic, you know, what are the sorts of questions that somebody asks in the first 10, 20, 30 seconds of a conversation about your product or service? And then structure your content hierarchy, the navigation, the interactions, everything follows that conversation. Then what you've done is created a flow that gives the user exactly the kind of information he or she needs up front without anything else, because it's just mimicking a natural conversation. And then it leads into the detail as it would naturally if you were having that conversation in real life. So that's the core of it, is to find that balance. You have to have conversations offline, I think. You have to have conversations offline that are realistic. And the best way that I tend to help people do this is to have them reverse roles. Like, suddenly you as a subject matter expert, nope, you're not the subject matter expert anymore. You're the user. Start asking the person sitting across the table from you. And that helps people to think about what that conversation might actually be.
Can you talk a bit about building trust once you've kind of got a user in a flow already, and then it's time to get them to give you some sensitive information, say like a social security number?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're going to have these sorts of like mint.com or PayPal experiences where you have to have the person give you some sensitive data, this requires transparency and trust, you know, more than just a marketing website where you're clicking around and there isn't this sort of, you know, ask. So, you know, we were doing this with Fast Customer. We had to get people's phone numbers in order to work. In order for our application to actually work, we had to get a phone number. So we would say, you know, over and over again to the point where we felt like it was redundant. You know, we're not going to use your phone number for anything. We would never, ever sell your data. And still, we would get emails from people on a regular basis asking us, why are you asking for my phone number? What are you going to do with my data? So it is a concern. And the best way to continually build trust with people in a Netflix sign-up process, for example, is that when you're asking for something sensitive from someone, is to tell them why you're asking for it exactly and then reassure them that you'll never do anything with it except, you know, use it in order to do whatever you need it for in the first place. And that's the sort of, you know, to be able to be transparent about that and upfront about it is the best way to reassure the person who's giving you that information that it's okay to do it. And then beyond that, it's all just delivering on that process. I mean, the first time that something gets hacked or the first time that you get an email that you didn't agree to and it's got some sensitive data and is probably going to be the last. I mean, people are not cool with that, and nor should they be. So being transparent about it and then protecting it fiercely is the best way to account for building trust over time.
Do you have any recommendations for how design teams can balance search engine optimized language versus natural language, plain language?
Yeah, absolutely. I love this because so often, natural language is already what is the keyword in the search engine. I mean, people don't use words like convert, you know, increase, decrease. Like, these are sales and marketing words that we think we have to have on our home pages, and we don't. And they certainly don't need to exist in the title tags and meta description of content on the page as well. But I would say to find the natural language just takes going to Google AdWords keyword tool. Just go to the Google Keywords tool and start looking for, you know, what are the words that people are using in your space? You know, so if you've got a board game, let's say you're trying to sell a board game, and you go to Google AdWords Keyword tool and you're looking for board games, and then you start searching for some titles of specific board games or chess or something like that. You're just in there exploring what kinds of searches and how many monthly searches, you know, globally even, that people are using as part of their regular language. Which of those things can you just translate to your homepage? So maybe you've got some meta copy that's already got that information in it, keyword rich copy. But a lot of it is just, you know, getting comfortable as a culture to use the kind of language that people use in real life, moving away from the marketing words that we've come to expect from a lot of these sites. They're not SEO optimized and they're not like person optimized either. So they're really just doing nobody good except the person who writes it and feels pretty good about him or herself.
Well, Steph, thanks so much for joining us again and talking a bit more about some of the questions that folks had. To our audience, thanks for listening in and for your support of the UIE Virtual Seminar Program.
Purchase access to recordings of all of our previous virtual seminars in our virtual seminar catalog. Just go to uie.com/virtual_seminars. As always, thank you for listening.